Genesis chapter 44. The context, remember, is Jacob's sons are coming to Egypt to buy food because of the severity of the famine. They interact with Joseph, who is running Egypt, but they don't know it's Joseph. And he starts, remember, we saw last time, starts testing them on their sins of the past in very different ways, but testing the same sins, and to see if they have changed. But while he's busy with these tests, he shows them extraordinary goodness. Remember, he gives them money, the food for free, returning their money to them. And they go back, but there's a test on them, and they have to come back to Egypt for more food, and they have to bring Benjamin along. And that's going to, in many ways, be the clincher test. How they treat Benjamin is going to be a test of whether they've changed at all. If they're still the same dishonest, evil sons that they were many years ago when they got rid of him. Or if with the exact same temptation, but it's going to make the temptation really easy for them to get rid of Benjamin. He's going to test whether they've changed or not. But in the meantime, he's showing them goodness. And the text clued us in that this goodness is actually God using the very evil that they did to show them a lot of good. So God is the character here. We're starting to get a glimpse of God here, that God isn't just the one who made the earth good and then man sinned and God is kind of dealing with man's sin. But God can even take the very sinful deeds of man and make those deeds have great results. He's not just a good God and not an evil God like mankind is evil. He is a God who can turn evil into good. So you're starting to see that glimpse of God's character here. They are back in Egypt now. The sons are for a second time. And remember, with Jacob's great resistance, really, still allowed Benjamin to go. So Jacob is not happy, but the sons are back in Egypt. Verse 1, Genesis chapter 44. Then he commanded, this is Joseph. Now remember, he brought them into his house, seated them in birth order too, yet fascinating, and blessed Benjamin, extraordinary. They drank, were merry with him. We see at the end of chapter 43. Verse 1, then he commanded the steward of his house, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. So again, extraordinary goodness. Give them as much food as they could possibly take back, and give them their money back. It's for free. And verse 2, put my cup, the silver cup, very special one, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest with his money for the grain. And the steward did as Joseph told him. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this. When he overtook them, he spoke to them these words. They said to him, why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we found in the mouths of our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. That's the previous time Joseph did that. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. He said, let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent. Excuse me. Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack, and he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey and then returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination? And Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found. But he said, far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose cup, in his hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father. Lots of questions, right? key verse is of key sentence that immediately sets us up for the big picture of the story is in verse 4, where the servant comes to them, and in the words of Joseph, he says, "Why have you repaid evil for good?" A reminder here that Joseph has been extraordinarily good to them. Once again, giving them as much food as they can and doing it for free, returning the money to them. And they have done him evil. Now, ironically, in this situation, they haven't done him evil. They haven't taken a cup. Joseph had told the steward to put the cup in Benjamin's sack. So they're all innocent. But the charge reminds us of what has happened. They have done Joseph evil. Joseph has done them good. And Joseph was testing to see if they are again going to do evil for all the good he does. And so the charge is a fair charge, even though in this particular case of the cup, it's thankfully a false charge. It's just to test them. And so it's evil for good. An accurate accusation for their actions against Joseph in chapter 37. He was the son sent from the father to go check up on them, a good deed. And they had returned him evil for good. And so now it's a similar situation that they are experiencing. And it's a reminder that Joseph has done them a lot of good. And they admit that even, right? Then there's this odd phrase in verse 5. The servant says, "Is it not from this cup that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination?" I'm like, what was Joseph doing? Okay, what on earth is he doing with this cup? That was a common practice with the wise men and sorcerers and conjurers of Egypt and for many kingdoms to come and other nations too. To have the cupbearer of the king would not just be the one who gives him drinks, okay? It's not just the barman. He's also the one who has the cup by which the king can discern decisions, wisdom. They would search, ask the gods for wisdom, and men like the cupbearer, the wise men, he would be the chief wise man typically, would discern that put the liquid in the cup, and before he gives it to a king, they would do magic with it to discern what the gods would have and decide. And so that's the charge here. It's basically a charge saying this cup is the most important cup in the kingdom. Okay, you didn't just go for kind of steal a bit of crockery on the side here. You went for the cup by which the nation will make wise decisions against other nations. You've taken that away. In other words, it's like stealing the gods of some people. You know you can beat a nation when you took their source of wisdom and counsel away, right? And so back to the original accusation of you are spies. Yeah, this is kind of still part of that same picture. Now we know that, and again in verse 15, right, Joseph himself says, "What deeds is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" It's not an admittance to divination, in fact, from the rest of his character. We already know he's not practicing divination, because what is Joseph's own stated source of knowing divine truth? Well, it's God. Remember the interpretation of the dreams. He kept telling Pharaoh, "It's your wise men with their divination couldn't do it. Your cup was useless then. I know God, and God reveals dreams." So we know Joseph is not claiming, saying, "I actually practice divination like the pagans too." He's just continuing to test them and showing them his authority and his insight and his wisdom in a purely Egyptian thing. They don't know he's this brother yet, right? And so when he says, "I can indeed practice divination," he's saying, "Look, I'm that man." Okay, it's all false, this divination stuff. But if somebody here can do it, it's me. I'm running the country. And therefore, don't lie to me. Don't deceive me. It's, again, part of the test. How honest are they going to be? It's just a little bit of a fearful test to them. Then, verse 12, another little detail here. The steward search, beginning with the eldest, ending with the youngest. And again, a little insight there that the steward knew things about this family that they never revealed to him. And remember the seating arrangement too. These are all grown men. Okay, so yes, one is maybe turning gray already and the other one is still trying to grow a beard. But the exact nuance of 10 sons, 11 sons now, of the age, you're not going to get that right. Okay. And so again, a little insight there. And then going from oldest to youngest too, the tension is mounting. You can feel it. Everybody take your bags off. The oldest says Reuben. And everybody takes the bags off. He searches Reuben and then Judah. And he goes through all of them. And it's not found. It's not found. It's not found. It's not found. By the time you get to 8 and 9, you're like, yo, Benjamin, you better not have it in your bag. Okay, tension mounts for the fate of Benjamin. It's all about Benjamin. Verse 14, and then he finds it in Benjamin's sack, so they're like, oh, no, we can't just get rid of Benjamin here. They all go back and say, we'll all be your servants. And verse 14, when Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there, not surprising, it was just a short trip for the steward. And they fall before him on the ground. Don't miss that little detail, right? He is still remembering the dreams of the brothers falling down before him. Verse 16, Judah is the prominent brother here. That's very significant. There's a reason it's told. He's the prominent brother. Now, he's not the oldest. Reuben is. But Judah was the particularly evil brother in chapter 37. And so the fact that Judah is playing a key role now is very, very significant. You as the reader look at this as like, wait, Reuben was the one who was trying to say he's going to pull Joseph out of the pit again. But then while he was gone, Judah was the one who said, hey, let's sell him to the Midianites so that we're not guilty of murder. Because so Judah is the evil brother. And so when Judah gets mentioned here every time, he's the one in charge, it seems, of the brother's responses. You're like, yo, I know this is going to end for poor Benjamin. I wish Reuben was running the show here instead of Judah. It's Judah, 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 every time. And so Judah, verse 16, admits guilt. He says, God has found out the guilt of your servants. Now, he's not admitting guilt for a crime he didn't commit. He doesn't say, we are guilty of taking the cup. He just says, God has found out guilt. Not Joseph found guilt for something we didn't actually do. Just for all he knew, they were innocent. But he's like, God has found out our guilt. That's the only comment made. We don't know exactly what he means with that, but it's not the cup. Because that would be false guilt. He wasn't guilty. And it wasn't Joseph finding it out. He says, God is dealing with us for our sins. He's guilty before God. And then, verse 17. Joseph said, far be it from me that I should do so. I'm not going to take all of you as my slaves. I'm just taking Benjamin. The rest of you go home in peace. Go to your father. Like, kind of like, hey, good to see you. Thanks for coming back. I just wanted Benjamin. You guys can go. Have a good day. Send greetings to your dad. It's kind of a very casual end. What is Joseph doing in this? He's still testing their honesty. He's testing what they will do with their youngest brother, his only real brother, remember? And he's making it as easy as possible for them to commit the same crime all over again. To get rid of their youngest brother. They don't have to come up with a plan. He comes up with a plan for them. You can literally go back home, say, Jacob, peace from the ruler of Egypt, but we have terrible news. Benjamin had stolen a cup, and so the guy caught him, and he's now in service of the king. He's alive and well, but he's serving the ruler of Egypt. They could have done that with a 100% clear conscience. You could almost sense Judah kind of looking at the brothers and saying, this is better than we could have planned. Okay, what we did to Joseph was kind of a spur of the moment. It was really rough on the edges plan. It worked out great. We dealt with it all, but it kept changing, and it was kind of a bit awkward and stuff. And this one's literally given to us. Like, it would be stupid not to use it. Benjamin, favorite son all over again. Even in Egypt, he's being treated special. If they were the same men, then this would have made it super obvious because this was handed to them on a platter to commit the same crime. You're bitter and angry against Benjamin. You can get rid of him and honestly give your dad a story. Verse 18. What's Judah going to do? Then Judah went up to him and said, O my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. He's like, can I just speak to you privately a little moment? My lord asked his servant, saying, Have you a father or a brother? And we say to my lord, We have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. It's a great speech by Judah. Okay, if you don't know, we're pretending like we don't know where it's heading. This is a great speech. Judah is hitting all the key points that makes Benjamin the same as Joseph. And his father loves him. End of 20. 21. Then you said to your servants, Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him. We said to my lord, The boy cannot leave his father. For if he should leave his father would die. Now they care about Jacob too. Then you say to your servants, Unless your younger brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord. And when our father said, Go again, buy us a little food, we said, We cannot go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, You know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, Surely he has been torn to pieces, and I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs and evil to Sheol. So Judah's elaborating on how Benjamin and Joseph is similar, and he's elaborating on how Jacob was treated when the first son left, was sold, and how he would respond if Benjamin, anything happened to Benjamin. Verse 30, Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. You can literally see Judah picturing Jacob looking at them coming, and he doesn't care who's on what donkey, he's just trying to see Benjamin's face over the horizon as they arrive. He'll die. And verse 32, For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father. Remember that speech? Saying, If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father. You see the 2 points in that last sentence, last two sentences, last verse. Judah is saying, how on earth can I go back to my father if, let's go back to chapter 37, Joseph is not with me? How on earth can I be the one who goes to my father and gives him such bad news and see how it affects my father? Now that's not what he was thinking in chapter 37. Chapter 37, he's the one that's like, Hey, let's sell him. Then at least we didn't kill anyone. And we'll just tell Dad. Don't worry about Dad. We'll just tell him. We'll kind of dip his clothes in blood or something, tear it up a bit. We'll just say something must have caught him. We found his clothes. Judah was the one who got rid of Joseph and was seemingly callous about how it would affect his father. Now it's the other way around, isn't it? I think Judah has changed. It's like, there's no way I will do to Benjamin what I did to Joseph. There's not a chance that I'll do that ever again. There's no way I'm coming to my dad even with a legitimate story the way we came with a false story back then. So, Judah has been the bad one in chapter 37. He's again the active one here in chapter 44. But I think he's passed the test that Joseph set up so brilliantly for him. Don't you think? This Joseph-like scenario is acknowledged. The favoritism of Jacob to Benjamin is justified rather than resented. And the likelihood of doing Jacob any more harm is inconceivable. Now, we look at it and say, well, I think he passed the test. But what's Joseph really up to? Like, up to now, some of the tests actually seemed a bit strange to us, a bit harsh. We realized they weren't once we thought through it. But this is a pretty good speech by Judah. Chapter 45, verse 1. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. You could probably imagine some of Joseph's struggles to maintain his composure when his brothers came, especially the first time. That would have been a surprise, obviously, a little bit. Suddenly looking up at the next customer and it's all of them. So you can imagine some of that. But at this point, he realized everything that Joseph wanted to know, he now knows. And he's overwhelmed, it says. He could not control himself because of the speech by Judah, especially those last two questions. Those kind of tie it up nicely in a bow for us, right? He cannot control himself. He's not out to get them. He's not vengeful. And this emotional response is not merely, okay, it's gone on long enough, let me tell you who I am. It's finally realizing how amazing everything has changed with it. He's overcome by it. And so he chases everyone out except his brothers. And so no one was there when Joseph says, "I'm Joseph," reveals himself to them. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. It doesn't necessarily mean he was wailing that the other side of town could hear it. Maybe some of the servants were kind of like, "Don't leave this our boss with all these men." So maybe eavesdropping a bit. Pharaoh eventually heard it. It was told Pharaoh. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And I do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And, and God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over the land of Egypt." Oh, profound commentary on these events, right? Up to now, God was frequently acknowledged. The son saying, the brother saying, God is visiting our guilt on us. And the servants say, "No, God has been good to you." And God is frequently mentioned. And finally, we see the whole picture from God's point of view. They were super distressed, realizing he's their brother and he's their superior in a dramatic way. But Joseph says, "Don't be distressed, don't be angry, don't even be distressed over your own actions." And he reminds them, "You are the ones who sold me to Egypt." He says, "Because you don't understand what God was doing. So let me explain it to you. When you sold me to Egypt, God was sending me to Egypt. While I was in Egypt and going through all kinds of stuff, you guys were back home. What you don't realize is God was raising me up so that when this famine comes, you would be left alive. You would survive the drought." And so this link back to God is preserving his people is very, very clear. And the big issue, obviously, here is their evil has become their good. Not because their evil was redeemed in some way, but because God turned their evil upside down. God was accomplishing something that was the exact opposite of what their deeds tried to accomplish. Instead of killing one brother, they, by trying to kill the one brother, saved the entire nation. Well, not that. God turned it up to them. Verse 9. "Hurry up! Go up to my father. Say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen.'" That's an area of Egypt. "And you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There in Goshen I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. You realize up to now, it's still just a one-way conversation. He basically says, look, I want you guys to go back as though you had the best time, best trip of your life. Don't go back in guilt or anything like that. You go back and you're like, hey, we met the ruler. It ends up being Joseph. Can you believe it, Dad? We saw Joseph again. And Joseph is the king. He's amazing. We were in his house. He's got all this stuff. And he said, come. I'll give you a big area of Egyptian land to live in. You'll be close to me then. He starts to run Egypt. In fact, it's important that he does because this drought has been gone for 5 years. And we're going to run out of money eventually. So you'll take care of us if we're close to him. And so come, bring everything. Just come. It's amazing. It's like you going on a trip to another part of the world on a tourist trip, and you come back and like, it was so amazing. It blew my mind. And you tell us of all the beautiful things you saw and experienced, and then you're like, it's so amazing. I booked us tickets. We're all going together next time. None of the, go back to your father and you tell him exactly what you did in chapter 37. None at all. Excessive goodness. Verse 16. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come, it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this. Gotta like it. The king said, do this. Do this. Load your beasts, go back to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. If you're friends of Joseph, you get the best. And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. So Pharaoh says, you guys need to obey me. Go get your dad, bring him back. You guys are going to get the best of the land. And then he says to Joseph, you're commanded to tell them, actually take of our wagons and stuff so that your wives and children don't have to walk and things like that. Just take all the modes of transport you need from us, and that will make your trek back much easier. The sons of Israel did so, verse 21. And Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. To his father he sent as follows, 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. And then he sent his brothers away, and as they departed he said to them, do not quarrel on the way. I still think that's the best line in this whole story. No fighting. When it says he sent to his dad these donkeys with all the goods, the donkeys are part of the gift. This is Pharaoh, or Egypt, Joseph, treating Jacob as the greater one. Saying, you get the best of what we have. In fact, we're going to start giving you gifts to show you honor. Extraordinary goodness from Joseph. That's understandable. Because he has the right perspective on things, and he loves his father, loves his brothers. But even from Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the one going even beyond what Joseph promised. Because Pharaoh can obviously offer more. So it's this excessive goodness. And then as they went, he said to them, do not quarrel on the way. And maybe there was still a little bit of Joseph that's like, now don't you guys go and fight over the details, okay? Because of God's twisting of your evil into good, I am able to show you incredible goodness. Now, you don't go and sit and fight about anything. Because like you tell your kids after they've had the best day ever, and then they grumble about ice cream wasn't the right flavor or something. Okay, no, you go and be thankful. Be thankful. So they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father, Jacob. And they told him, Joseph is still alive, and he's ruler over all the land of Egypt. And his heart became numb, but he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." It's quite a big statement there, the fact that it changes back to his national name, Israel, instead of Jacob there in that last verse. Is a literary clue for us to recognize this is the nation that came from Abraham. Remember, "I'll make of you a great nation." It's the nation Israel. And when he says, "Jacob, my son, is still alive, I will go and see him before I die," he's saying, before I die, there's going to be a solution to us possibly all dying because of the famine. So it's just a very visual or very vivid reminder that we're dealing with a nation who's now going to live. And everything is going to be fine even before... if the main guy, Jacob, dies, everything is going to be fine. So there's a bit of a commentary at the end here. So, what happens in chapter 44 and 45? Joseph finally raises and customizes his test to such a degree that he can see exactly, in the easiest of ways, if his brothers have changed. There's overwhelming evidence that they have changed completely. And so, Joseph fits an end to the test. He got what he needed to know. He reveals himself to them. They're stunned and scared because of it all. And he keeps assuring them and reassuring them, promising them abundance of goodness. And then says, "Go and bring the whole nation here. There's all area of Egypt that you'll get, this Goshen, a beautiful piece of land, something Egyptians weren't really using, we'll see that later. But it was a beautiful piece of land. And you can settle there with everything. You bring your old dad's mini little empire, nomadic empire here. In fact, we'll provide the transport, we'll provide the food." Kind of get the impression he says, "I'm giving you provision." He's not giving them their sacks of grain anymore. He's just giving them provision to get home and come back. Because then they'll be taken care of. So he provides everything. The key phrases here is not "don't quarrel along the way," as funny as that was. The key phrases are the steward's words from Joseph to his brothers: "Are you returning evil for all the good?" That gets to the crux of the issue. Then you have Joseph saying, "I'll just keep Benjamin. You guys go in peace. Don't worry about this." And Judah's response then is, "How could we ever do that to a brother of ours again, a son of Rachel and Jacob's again, and how can we ever do it to Jacob again, to our father?" And then there's reconciliation, and God provides, through their evil, the national deliverance of Israel, still in its early years, the first generation of a nation, delivering them from inevitable death by famine. Now they're going to come to Egypt. It's not exactly a promised land now, is it? So we've got another problem brewing. But for now, it's amazing. They went back to their brother, told them everything. He didn't believe them at first, understandably. When they told them the stories, he finally believed them. And next time, we'll look at their trip to Egypt. Questions? Comments? All right, let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this account from history of all the stories of that era that could be told. This is the only one told, and it's told in such personal details. And yet, Father, it starts opening our minds to what you are capable of. And it gives us just a bigger perspective of the affairs of mankind. And though we don't always know all the details of our particular life, you have given us a glimpse of one of the people lives in that distant history and what you've done with it. And so for us, Father, we've got great confidence that our sin, even though it's great at times, is forgiven through Jesus Christ, and you will use even our sin to accomplish your purposes. How much more will you not use just the ordinary affairs of life that are not per se sinful to accomplish your purposes? Give us strong faith in that, especially when we're the ones experiencing the evil of others. And Father, may we be those testimonies of strong faith in you that doesn't return evil with evil, as Joseph so easily could have done, but instead we return evil with good and we respond in good, even to those who would persecute us. And we know, Father, through that you've already saved the nation of Israel from famine. You've saved many, even through persecuted times. With eternal salvation, you saved them from their sins because of the good responses of the faithful. So stir our hearts with grand thoughts of you. May the evil of this world never cause us anxiety or overwhelm us ever again. For Christ's sake, we ask.